Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Senate Republicans and the White House continue to squabble over a plan to extend low student loan interest rates that without action will rise again on July 1st. Behind the squabbling, however, is a larger question. To what extent is government responsible for making sure that Americans, every American, has access to higher education? Is a college degree or is college a right or a choice? Coming up, we'll hear from two corners on that issue. I think there are many corners. We'll hear from two of them. Joining us now to sort of lay the groundwork is OSU English professor Frank Donahue. He's written extensively on the present and future state of higher education. His most recent book is called The Last Professors, The Corporate University and the Fate of the Humanities. He also writes a blog for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Thanks.
Question for our listeners. Have you attended a college thinking that you should go, but found out later, after spending a lot of money, that it not only wasn't for you, but it also wasn't necessary? Give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513. So, Frank Donahue, in the arguments around higher education as a right or a choice, are the lines clearly drawn? Is everybody just all on one side or all on the other?
No, I think there's a wide range of opinions, and I think that that's kind of illustrated very well by the local debate about whether or not to extend the low student loan interest rates. That's a debate that both Romney and Obama have chimed in on, and it's extremely local. It only applies to loans that have not yet been originated, and it's very much a kick the can down the road approach to the whole issue of funding higher education. It only applies to student loans. It only applies to government loans, Stafford loans. Those loans, for the most part, don't come close to financing the total cost of what it takes to send someone to college. So it's really only a drop in the bucket in the first place as far as financial aid goes. It doesn't solve the problem of how you finance a college education. And so for both of them to support it, which they both do, doesn't really mean a whole lot. That's the local subject. The bigger subject is that we have a financial aid system in the United States that really doesn't work. And so when you raise the question or when you format this debate in terms of whether college is a right or a choice, it would really only be a right if it were free. And it's clearly not. If government were willing to pay for higher education for anyone who wanted it in its entirety, then it would be a right, just like K-12 education is. If the government is not willing to do that at all, then it would be a choice.
But some people might say that even with K-12, it's a right, but not all people have equal rights when it comes to the right of education. Some kids go to schools that are undersupplied. The teachers, they don't have enough teachers. They don't have enough paper and pencils. So there's that, too.
Right. The government supplies, states, school districts supply a minimal level of education for people at the K-12 level, but that's it. The government doesn't do even that much for people going to college, yet at the same time we have a president, and I would assume that Governor Romney feels the same way, that many more Americans should go to college than currently do. We currently have lagged behind a lot of other developed countries in the number of people we send to college. Countries like South Korea, like Denmark, send a lot more people to college than we do. The question
at government expense.
Right. At government expense, well-funded. Australia's ahead of us. Many other countries are. And that's because they have a better system for funding students through college. It's one thing to say we should send more people to college. And in each of their speeches, presidential candidates and other politicians always emphasize that we should focus on STEM subjects so that we can get farther ahead in the knowledge-based, technological-based world that's awaiting us. But they don't say how we're going to pay for it. And increasingly, the burden for paying for it is falling on students themselves. If we really want to do something about making college a right, we need to do something about how we finance it. And the financing model that we have currently in place is so dysfunctional and so complex that I think people contemplating going to college and their parents just throw their hands up.
My guest is Frank Donahue. He is a professor of English at Ohio State University. He's also written a book about the future of higher education. If you have a question or comment for him, if you want to share your story about higher ed and how you went and discovered that maybe it wasn't for you after you spent a bunch of money, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Steve in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to let you know, I grew up here in Columbus. I knew what I was interested in for a profession very early in my life, fortunately. I got into the real estate industry when I was 18 years old, and while I had attained my real estate license, I was going to school at Ohio State University and trying to balance the work and study, and it was difficult. However, what I want to say is after 3 years, I ended up dropping out because I got so involved in the real estate industry, and then I went into commercial real estate, and I had many, many good years, and it was the book Outliers. My timing was just perfect,
mm-hmm.
And if I hadn't dropped out and gone full-time in the real estate, commercial real estate, and was able to keep going for years and years and had wonderful experiences and income, I would have missed out on my opportunity. So I'm not typical of today's
dropouts.
Right. And because I knew early on what I wanted to do, and it was sales oriented, however it was in the real estate industry.
Well, let me ask you this, Steve. Did college benefit you at all, even those 3 years? Did it?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll always remember the courses I took. I am going to go back at some point and finish. Obviously the social experiences, I still participated in social activities and made friendships even that I have today.
Those social activities, you mean football? Come on, let's just say.
Football, you got it. Basketball, too. Actually, I was more of a basketball fan than
okay.
a football fan.
All right.
I went to a lot of OSU basketball games. So it's interesting. I have two kids. One is in college, and one is going to be in high school, and they see me as a interesting subject because their father does not have a degree. However, he had many years of success and has reinvented myself in the real estate industry, and even with what's happened in the last 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they know the value of the education. They know that when they go to college, they're not going to be messing around, that they'll be they know what they're going to be their goals.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about that, the idea of the goal. So, Steve, thanks a lot for sharing your story.
Sure, Ann. You take care.
Thank you. You too.
Cool. Bye-bye.
If you want to give us a call, the number is 614-292-8513. If you'd rather, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. And if you can express yourself in 140 characters or less, you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Back in the 60s and 70s, I guess 65 is when Stafford
yes.
Loans and Pell Grants came out. Higher education clearly was deemed a greater good for mm-hmm. society. And you and I were talking before the show started, a lot of that was triggered by World War II or
yes.
post-World War II generation.
Right. I think that's a critical turning point. That changed the demographic of the higher education population. After the GI Bill, which was signed into law in 1944 and followed by a bill of equal proportion after the Korean conflict, what you saw was a dramatic shift in the demographic of the people who went to college. You saw people who never would have been able to afford to go to college suddenly flooding colleges and universities across the country. At that point, at that moment in history, college was a right. Government was subsidizing college students entirely and giving them subsidies to go to college.
A lot of college students, in other words, the returning vets.
In fact, the number is 11.7 million. And these are people who never would have been able to go to college before.
And they did this, the government did this very consciously because it believed that that was going to be a good thing for society.
Well, they were really looking back on World War I when veterans came back from the war and had no way of readjusting to American life, no jobs, no nothing. And the real name of the GI Bill is the Servicemen's Readjustment Act. So it was a way of reintegrating into American society. And one of the ideas was, let's put them in a position to find a place in the American professional society. The best way to do that is to send them to college and give them college degrees so that they can become accountants and journalists and possibly candidates for graduate study. And when that happened, you saw a whole generation of people who never would have been able to afford to go to college had it not been for the war, attending college. It also had a geometric effect in the sense that those people who graduated from college through the benefit of the GI Bill, they went on to expect their children to go to college. My father's a perfect example. He benefited from the GI Bill because he was a veteran of World War II, and his expectation of his children was not, are you going to go to college, but which college are you going to go to? So that had the effect of mushrooming the college population in the United States over the next two generations.
In the 60s and 70s.
To the point where now 18 million people in America go to college. And it's a gargantuan leap from what you would have seen in terms of college population in the 1920s and 30s.
Is the debate then that we're going to get into more in terms of whether colleges are right or a choice, is that... When did that start to emerge as a topic of conversation in Washington and at the state houses?
Well, I think it started to emerge, I would say, in the late 80s and early 90s, because during the Reagan and Bush administrations in the 80s and early 90s, what you started to see was that Pell Grants and Stafford loans stopped keeping pace with the rising cost of college
tuition. Started right. Outpacing the rate of inflation at that point.
Right. If I can use myself as an example, I paid for my college education entirely through Stafford loans. All my parents had to do was chip in for room and board. And I worked summer jobs for discretionary income, and that was it. I didn't work while I was in school itself, and my college wasn't an onerous burden at all, and I went to a private university. Now that private university, which charged $3,200 a year when I was a freshman,
those were the good old days,
charges $48,000 a year. And Stafford loans and Pell Grants don't come near covering that. And what happened during the predominantly Republican administrations of the 80s and early 90s was that they didn't tie Stafford loans or Pell Grants to the rising cost of college educations. And then there's a separate debate we could have about why the cost of college has gone up.
Right. Which is an issue we are going to get into later in the program.
Yes, and a crucial one, too, I think.
My guest is Frank Donahue. His most recent book is The Last Professors, The Corporate University, and the Fate of the Humanities. He also writes a blog for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're talking about higher education today. Is it a right or is it a choice? What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back with some other points of view on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Wisconsin's epic recall battle over Governor Scott Walker and its vote. We'll look at the fallout. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Get access to our station anytime online at WOSU.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day, from the convenience of your computer or mobile device. Listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime online at WOSU.org. 62 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Sunny skies for the day today, warming up to a high of 75. Partly cloudy for tonight. There is a slight chance of rain, a low of 53 degrees. A beautiful day for Thursday, sunshine and a high of 77, partly cloudy Thursday night and a low of 55. And more sunshine looking ahead to Friday with a high near 80. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
We're talking about higher education today. Is it a right or is it a choice? Still with us is OSU professor Frank Donahue. His most recent book is The Last Professors, The Corporate University and the Fate of the Humanities. He also writes a blog for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Joining us now from just two perspectives in the debate about higher education as a right or a choice is Jane Shaw. She's president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. Jane Shaw tends to argue that higher education is a public good, but not necessarily a good public good. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you.
Also with us is Sandy Baum. Sandy is a policy analyst for the College Board and senior fellow at the George Washington University School of Education and Human Development. Sandy argues that higher education is a good public good and should be subsidized by the government. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Again, question for our listeners. Have you attended a college thinking that you should go but found out later after spending a bunch of money that maybe it wasn't for you, maybe it wasn't necessary? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. First of all, Sandy and Jane and Frank, let's make sure we're all using the same words because it does come up in some of the literature I've been reading. What do we mean by public good? Are we referring to that as in goods and services or as in society is better because of it? Sandy, or I should start with Jane. Jane, what do you think? How should we refer to this?
The term public good actually is one that economists use, and what they mean specifically is something that is very difficult to provide privately because people can't just go and buy it. So it's kind of morphed in the public understanding to something that has to be good.
Positive.
But really, as a positive thing, but it also should have that technical meaning that it's very difficult to provide it without some kind of third party or government intervention.
Sandy Baum?
Yes, that's a very important point. And another aspect of it is that if something is a public good, it means that the benefits don't just go to the person who's buying it or consuming it. They're spread out. And one of the problems with the use of the term that's so imprecise is that it's clear that the benefits of higher education are broader than just for the students, but the students get a lot of the benefits too. So it has to be really clear that we're not saying, is it something that is either just a benefit to everybody or just a benefit to the student?
Another issue that pops up is the issue of goals, and I think Steve from Westerville, our first caller, sort of brought that up, that his children, even though he didn't finish college, because of his experience in college and his life experience being very successful outside of, besides the lack of a college degree, they're very goal-oriented. College isn't just a lark. The goal makes a big difference, doesn't it, Jane Shaw? You've written about that.
Absolutely. You know, when you first phrased the question, is this a right or a choice, it reminded me of my driver education teacher in high school who said, driving is not a right, it's a privilege. And I don't know whether legally you could, or legalistically you might say that there's a right to education or to higher education, but certainly it is something that in the case of driving, you have to be prepared for it and you have to follow the rules. And really, I think that's a very important point about colleges today. Students, in many cases, are not prepared, and yet because they have this pressure, everyone expects them, their parents expect them, the government expects them to go on to college. So they are there, but they're not really taking in the true academic scholarship that college at least one time used to be about. And we know that from some statistics.
Sandy, what about that? Should college still be something you could just go to and have fun and have it just some, you know, absorb knowledge? Or, we know that people are, because of the price of it, are becoming more concerned about the outcome.
Well, education has never been something that can provide benefits without the input from the student. Of course, it's not something you just go to the store and buy. It requires motivation, effort, participation. It also requires support from the people around you and from your institution. So it's a combination. It's never been something that can just be handed to you, and that would make no sense at all.
And so there's the argument that as long as most people, most of whom need financial aid, get it from the government, tuition and other costs associated with higher education increase. In other words, as long as the government keeps feeding the students to the universities, there's no incentive to keep tuition down or to have to compete for the students. And I know, Jane, you make that point in a lot of your writings.
Right. There is a desire to compete for students, certainly, but the problem is it's not connected to the price. Tuition has been going up, and I'd be interested in Professor Donahue's views, because he mentioned that he could talk about that as well, that the cost of college has just gone up enormously, faster than inflation for years and years. And why is that? Well, it does appear that one reason is that there's a lot of money available through Pell Grants, Stafford Loans, and private loans that tends to just push up the cost of tuition. Colleges are nonprofit organizations or public organizations. They don't have the bottom line that's traditional in a business, but they are a big business. So part of the problem is that availability of money, but there are other factors too.
Sandy Baum?
Well, actually, there's been a lot of study of the question of the impact. Is there an impact of federal financial aid on driving up college prices? And there's just no good evidence that that's the case. Certainly for Pell Grants go to low and moderate income students. It's true that a lot of those students would not be able to go to college if we didn't give them that money. And if we had fewer college students, we'd probably have fewer colleges. But the reality is that there are lots of explanations for rising prices. And the idea that if we just made it harder for students to be able to pay, that would solve the problem, is one that's not really supported by very good evidence.
Frank, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think one of the big reasons why, if you look at the spikes in college tuition, the biggest ones come at public institutions rather than private institutions. There's been a gradual but significant rise in tuition in private institutions, but a much higher rise in tuition at public universities. The biggest reason for that is that public universities don't have an endowment. They rely a lot more heavily on student tuition to pay for their everyday costs. And over the past couple of decades, really past three decades, states have been increasingly lowering the amount of money that they spend on state higher education, and to the point where I believe in Ohio the number is 7%. So the less states spend on higher education, the more state universities are required. They have no choice but to raise tuition. So that's a huge factor, I think, in the cost of tuition. It's not, I mean, you can make the argument that the more financial aid you make available, the more you give colleges free rein to raise tuition, because if the money's there, then the students can take advantage of it and pay. But you also have to really weigh into consideration the fact that states are being really starved off as far as money that they have available to invest in higher education.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest's Jane Shaw. She is president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, also Sandy Baum, senior fellow at the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at George Washington University, and Frank Donahue, professor at Ohio State University, author of The Last Professors, The Corporate University, and The Fate of the Humanities. Let's hear from some callers now. Brian in Worthington, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Well, thank you very much. Just quickly, it's too bad we started the conversation with Wright versus a choice, because right is kind of a very specialized term that would apply to like trial by jury or freedom of speech and so forth. That I don't think that really what we're talking about now is this something that the government should have say in, something that where the government should try to subsidize it or try to provide additional support to it, make get more people into college. And so calling it a rights kind of a little extreme, I think. the one thing that I've noticed is it does seem like the cost of college has been bid up like real estate, and so almost every university is costing $20,000-$30,000 a year now. There's schools like MIT that have open courseware, and Stanford has open courseware, where you can actually get the same degree for no money. But if you were to actually get the course credit, it'd cost you $30,000 to get the credit. And so it seems to me like there's something, the prices are bid up. There's something we could learn from, I think, these online schools like Khan Academy and Stanford and MIT. The colleges seem to have a monopoly that prevent anybody else from entering the industry and providing education for credit. So I think that's an important thing. And I just wanted to also mention that you talked about other countries like Japan and places where they subsidize education more. You know, that actually they basically subsidize the education to their cream of the crop, and that means that a lot of people would get left out, and so you kind of would ensure the 99% 1%. Social would continue. That's it for me, Anne. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Brian. And Frank, you were nodding when he mentioned that Japan is selective in
and other countries as well.
He's
making a great point. I mean, countries like Japan, like China, like India are essentially making a bet that they can compete in the new high-tech knowledge economy by educating their best and brightest. And I don't know whether the United States can make that same kind of wager by, in other words, fully funding our smartest students and letting the rest just drift.
Well, you know, Gene Shaw, you talk about government participation. I was curious about whether, you know, bringing up that issue of the best and the brightest, what happens to the best and the brightest who can't afford to go to college? Jane?
Well, it's interesting. Yes. Jay Matthews of the Washington Post kind of hurled out a challenge a year or so ago and said, is there any good student in high school who cannot get to college? And he has, as far as I know, not found anybody who fits that description.
But what do you mean? I guess, what do you mean by good? Because does it always have to be the golden boys and the golden girls? I mean, can a really good student come out of high school with a 3-point and have a very successful career ahead of them if they can get that college education and can contribute a lot? Does it always have to be,
absolutely. He wasn't even talking about the top students who are going to get the scholarships and so forth, but mm-hmm. someone who is well prepared and, as you say, a B average ought to be able to get you to college. But, you know, we have, and also an SAT score, for example, of even 850, you might be able to do well. That's 850 out of 1,600. Mm-hmm. And yet there are students who are going to college that have less than that. And there are also students going to college who simply are not interested in school, and that's why you have so much emphasis on the football teams and the fraternities and so forth. So I think we have to keep in mind that there has been an awful lot of pressure on students to go to college, but there's not as much examination of what happens to them when they go. After 6 years, only 63% of our students who entered intending to graduate have actually graduated, and that's a lot of people who are supported by loans, and they don't give up their loans when they drop out of college. I mean, that's almost the worst tragedy of higher education today.
Sandy Baum, so much of the subsidization has come in the form of, well, we'll give you a cut break on the interest rate on your loans. And as Jane just pointed out, a lot of people, that doesn't really make that much difference in the long run. What about the idea of college for kids who just really don't belong there, but they're being going there anyway?
Well, actually, one problem is that we have to define college. Mm. Because when we talk about college and we talk about fraternities and dormitories and parties, that is true for some segment of the college population. But college really means any kind of post-secondary education. So we're giving student loans and Pell Grants and degrees and certificates to people who are enrolled part-time, who many go to community colleges, to for-profit institutions. Many are getting, you know, degrees that are nowhere like bachelor's degrees, and they're studying for a specific occupation. So the idea, there was just a wonderful article in the New York Times today about what happens, what is the fate of people who don't go to college at all, and like almost nobody has a job. So most people need some post-secondary training. Obviously, there are many people who are not in any way interested in or prepared to go study for a bachelor's degree in philosophy, but I don't think anybody thinks that everybody should get a bachelor's degree, but the idea of post-secondary training is very important. And should you borrow for this? Borrowing reasonably? Absolutely. People are making an investment in themselves. It pays off for most people. It doesn't pay off for everybody, but borrowing reasonably makes total sense. It does not make sense to borrow $120,000 to get an undergraduate degree, and very few people do that sort of thing. On average, people with bachelor's degrees have borrowed about $25,000. So people need to know how to borrow well, and they need to be protected in case bad things out of their control happen.
Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you want to join the conversation. We're talking about higher education and whether or not it's a right or a choice. I'm going to talk to Steve on the West Side. Welcome, Steve.
Yes, thank you for having me. You asked if education is either a right or a choice. I think it's an obligation, a responsibility, because I went on education with the GI Bill, so you have to think, how does it affect defense? Look at how many students are going directly to the military to get that education. So I have a question for you. Is an educated society more likely to start a war? So thank you.
All right. That's a good question. I don't know if anyone's prepared to answer that one, though.
No, I'm not.
Sandy Baum, you're an economist. I did want to ask you, how do we or how should we calculate the benefit of higher education on the economy?
Well, there's the benefit to the student, which is partly measured in terms of earnings and job opportunities and other larger life opportunities. There's also the benefit to society. And we know that even though the number of people with college degrees has been increasing, the demand for those people in the labor force has been increasing even more. And so the gap between the earnings of high school graduates and college graduates has been growing. And it's not that it grows every year. It's very high, and over time it has been growing. And so we can see that employers want to hire people with college degrees, and they are willing to pay quite a premium for that. So that suggests that they are making really big contributions. There's also a lot of evidence that people with college education are healthier, they volunteer more, they vote more, they change their behaviors and attitudes, and that's not just correlation. There is considerable evidence that going to college changes you as a citizen. So all of those things are very important.
Jane Shaw, do you agree?
Well, yes, there's certainly a lot of benefit, whether it's actually produced by the college experience itself is a question. I mean, in the past, it's been the better students, the more who have gone to college, and certainly it is the persistent students who go through college and actually graduate. So there's some fuzziness there, but certainly education is valuable throughout our society. I think there's one thing to be concerned about, and that is that employers seem to be wanting a credential. There's been some evidence that it's not so much what is actually learned, but it's a convenient way, since there are so many graduates, to just sort people out. And so someone who didn't go to college but who had a similar but was capable just might not be able to get through the door. In fact, I know a number of people who have had that problem, even though they would have, in fact, in some cases, they were doing as good a job as the people who were hired on a permanent basis. So there is that concern about credentialing. The good news, I think, although it's going to cause ramifications of many sorts, is that this is changing. It looks as though there are sort of individuals around the world who are figuring out ways to provide credentials that are not college credentials but are still very useful. And you may have heard the term badges. If you can show that you have accomplished something, you get a badge, and that may be useful to an employer down the road. And next year, there's going to be a company called Straighter Line, which does teach courses, but it's going to allow individuals to take a test. It's called the Collegiate Learning Assessment, or CLA, and show that they know what college students are supposed to learn. So I think we're going to see a lot of change in the future.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll return to our conversation about higher ed in just a minute.
Your support of 89.7 NPR News right now keeps the programs you enjoy on the air and free of commercials. A basic membership starts at just $60. As a basic member, you'll receive the WOSU member card, good for dining discounts at more than 200 member card partners, and a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine. Make your first-time gift or renew your membership right now by becoming a basic member. Visit WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, stay with us for Hour 2 of All Sides and a discussion of the barriers to breastfeeding and other breastfeeding initiatives in the United States and here in Ohio. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 62 degrees with sunshine, sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 75, partly cloudy tonight and a low of 53. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Talking about higher education this hour, is it a right or is it a choice that you make in your life? My guests are Jane Shaw. She's president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education. Also with us, Sandy Baum. She's a senior fellow at George Washington University in the Graduate School of Education and Human Development. And Frank Donahue is here in the studio with me. He's a English professor at Ohio State University, but he also blogs for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he is the author of a book. It's called The Last Professors, The Corporate University, and the Fate of the Humanities. I wanted to hear from Jeremy right now. You've been waiting a while, Jeremy, and I'm curious to hear your story. Welcome to the show.
Why, thank you for having me. My story with higher education is a brief one. I spent all of my summer earnings from my high school job on my first quarter of college, and after 2 months decided it was not for me. And I guess to go back to the main issue you guys are discussing, is it a choice or a right? Like everything in life, it is a choice, but with choices come consequences, and you know, you got to weigh the pros and cons. And I didn't think it was going to benefit me, not with what I wanted to do with my life. And what it really comes down to for me, I feel like, is lately our society seems to water down education. I don't know how many times the state of Ohio has been taken to the Supreme Court on the issue of how they fund public schools in K through 12, let alone college. That's a separate issue. But college is the new high school. College is just high school 2.0. It's expected of you. It's how you get a good job and get a good salary and keep making money. But with that and the watering down of the education you're actually getting, I feel like I'm having trouble finding the words.
Let me ask you this. Did you feel like you were not counseled properly when you decided to go to college, that you didn't have somebody you could turn to? Because that's another issue we're going to talk about, is are colleges being fair to students in terms of, are they just accepting anybody who can just squeeze through the door or not? Do you think maybe you could have used some counseling?
Yeah, that would have been beneficial. But for colleges, I don't think it's about the quality of the education and the quality of the students necessarily. I think it's about squeezing as many people through the door as they can. It's a business now. It's the humanities, I like the title of, is it Frank, his book?
Frank Donahue, right.
Yeah, his book has a really nice title, and the humanities are dead. The humanities are dying. I feel like there is no value in knowledge for knowledge's sake and bettering ourselves as a species and a society. We really just want money, and we really just want to continue our class society and the income disparity we have come to know and enjoy, at least the wealthy have come to know and enjoy. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, Jeremy, thanks a lot for your call.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Take care. To what extent should universities be held responsible for the disengaged students, students clearly on a path of failure, but who are still paying the bills, still racking up the debt to pay the bills? Sandy Baum?
Well, it's a combination of the institutions and the students. I mean, it's not that the institutions can work magic for students, but institutions can, one, give students proper information before they enroll so they know what they're getting into, and two, provide a supportive environment. So there are many students, I mean, it's really true, it's been mentioned that the high schools are not doing a very good job of preparing people. That would make a huge difference if we gave people better preparation in high school, and wouldn't it be great if people graduated from high school ready to go into the labor market? They don't. So colleges and universities could do much more to make it improve the chances of students in succeeding, but they obviously can't solve the problem for students who don't put the energy in or aren't prepared to do what it takes to go to college.
Hey, Jane Shaw, you've written that students who attend public universities pay less than the full fare and are therefore less savvy consumers than they would be if they paid, you know, the full freight. You've also said they're less committed to becoming serious students and many never finish. That's a big generalization. I was wondering if you could maybe be more, go into a little bit more detail about what you mean there.
Yeah, well, I think that, again, this is kind of an economic point. I think that when you are not paying the full cost, if you are being, aren't going to take it as seriously. Now, that doesn't mean that we should have to pay the full cost, because I believe that the full cost is too high. And I think that in most universities, there is no essential cost control. And those state legislatures that are cutting back a little bit on the appropriations are probably doing a good thing, because they are forcing those schools to reduce their costs so much, or to some extent, and we'll see whether that really happens for a very long time. So certainly, this gets to the question of borrowing as well, and I see more and more columns written by in the newspapers advising people young people to consider whether they want to borrow so much. Money has been very readily available, and yet it's not paid for until the student drops out or graduates. These students at between 18 and 22 are often unable to really know what that $20,000 bill down the road is going to be like. So I think I would agree with Sandy Baum that this is a problem that's caused both by the student being naive and by the university not being as stringent as it should be. I believe that part of the problem is colleges are run like businesses. They are trying to get as many students as possible, and they have not stuck with high standards the way they ought to.
Some are perhaps, we've been talking sort of about public universities and then private nonprofit universities, I think, and we haven't brought up the topic of private for-profit universities.
Right.
Frank, can you talk about that? What's the difference in the students that they attract? And
well, they would claim that they are attracting or educating, training the most at-risk student population in the country by going after students who are in remote areas. They're specialists in online learning, but they've also been exposed as really being predatory, going after students who are completely unprepared, completely ignorant about the ways of college, and therefore much more easily convinced about the benefits of college in very inaccurate ways. And so right now we're in a situation where, and unable to afford it. And so right now we're in a situation where for-profit colleges and universities, most of them offering credentials or certificates or two-year degrees, are educating 13% of the country's college-age population, but are responsible for or bringing in 37% of all student loan debt. And that seems to me pretty shocking when you consider stories that have come out through federal investigations of their recruiting practices. So that seems to me a very dangerous situation, considering that for-profit universities are expanding. I'd also actually, on a separate note, want to pick up on Jeremy's story about how the humanities are dead. I actually found, I'm coming off a quarter where I taught two sections of first-year writing.
English professor.
Right, yeah. Where I taught two sections of first-year writing, so I'm teaching freshmen. I found the students to be actually, on the whole, well-prepared, very savvy, very intellectually curious, because I'm teaching them English, in some cases English literature. They were interested. At the same time, out of the 44 students that I taught, 30 of them, and I teach the course ethnographically, so I start with the assignment, how did you end up at Ohio State? What led you to choose to come to Ohio State? 30 of them had done extensive, or all of them had done extensive research, and 30 of them had decided on the basis of research they did in high school that they wanted to be engineers. 30 of them were engineering majors because they realized that that was the major with which they could graduate from college and start earning a lot of money on day one after graduation, so that if they had loans to pay off, they could start paying them off on day one. They saw college primarily in terms of return on investment. So they're incredibly savvy, actually, not going into college unprepared or unthinking at all. Two separate answers, but I think they're in some ways related. You've got students going to Ohio State who I think are very much aware of how colleges function as businesses, and then you've got students being preyed upon by for-profit universities who are completely unaware of how colleges work.
Sandy Baum, is there something we can do to help students or would-be students make those distinctions and make better choices?
I do think that we have to make more information more easily available and more transparent. So, for example, schools that graduate, you know, fewer than 20% of the people who enter, they should be required to disclose that. The government should disclose that. We should make sure everyone knows what they're choosing. But unfortunately, it's not simple because there's not one best college. I mean, you have to know yourself and your needs and your capacities, and the choices are different for each student. And it would be great if we had, you know, more high school guidance counselors and they knew about more about college. If we had sort of there are these one-stop centers for job training all over the country, we need centers like that that would help guide people into appropriate post-secondary choices with clear information about costs and about the prospects for success and what happens afterwards.
Jane Shaw, maybe it is a right to expect more information about the colleges you're considering?
Well, possibly. In any case, I think that things are changing. I agree that it's better knowledge about colleges and what they can do for a person. That's really what's needed. And I think that the fact that you're having this program, for example, that you're discussing this issue, it's certainly been in major papers around the country, the shocking amount of loans that some students have and then not being able to get a job. I think all of that is going to help not just students, but high school students, but their parents as well, to say, wait a minute, let's be more careful. Let's not take those big loans. Let's, if necessary, take a gap year, earn some money, then go to school. I think that what we really want, and I think we are going to get it, is a more knowledgeable consumer. And if I could just make one other point, I do want to say that, yes, this question of whether federal aid and federal loans is leading to tuition increases, it has been debated. I was thinking of the latest research, a paper on what's called the Bennett hypothesis, which argues this point. So I do want to say that I think a lot of the problem comes, and certainly with the problem, if that's what it is, with for-profits, depends upon there being so much money available from the federal government, and that should be reconsidered.
I want to get to a couple emails, one from Lauren. I feel like college is more of a privilege and not a right. If everyone goes to college, then more people are going to expect higher-paying jobs, and the lesser-paying jobs, like fast food and retail, are going to have fewer people wanting them. An email from Elizabeth. I would say that higher education is a right at this point. It is increasingly needed to get a job with a living wage, even with a bachelor's degree, forcing many of us to pursue graduate degrees to even get a foot in the door. Many of those who choose not to go to college end up locked into low-paying jobs with low prestige. I think it's all educational inflation, and it is frustrating, too, because young adults give up more years when they could be earning money to attend school. I want to grab a quick call from Jill in Dublin. You've been waiting a long time. I'm kind of curious about your idea. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Hi, thanks. I just kind of want to ask the question. Mm-hmm. It seems that companies are increasingly decreasing their support for tuition. They're not reimbursing tuition for their employees. There are certainly companies around town that will put their names on Ohio State buildings, but they won't reimburse their own employees for tuition. So I was kind of curious if your panel has comments on how that might be putting additional pressure on the government. And then the second question that I kind of have is really directed to executives around Ohio. You know, why they aren't investing increasing skill sets here when they, you know, put a lot of energy in outsourcing.
Well, Jill, we're not going to be able to get to all those questions. But let's first talk about companies helping. We just have about a minute left. So Jane Shaw?
I'm sorry to hear that. And it's something that I want to look into further.
Okay. And Sandy Baum?
Well, one question would be what kinds of jobs are companies willing to train people for? And they're going to be more willing to train people for jobs where they know they're going to get the return, not just train people to be able to go out into the labor market and look for other jobs.
Well, thank you so much, Sandy Baum, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Sandy Baum, she's a senior fellow at the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at George Washington University. And also Jane Shaw, thank you so much for joining us today, Jane.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Jane is president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education. And, of course, Frank Donahue with us from the beginning. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
You're welcome.
Frank is a professor of English at Ohio State University and author of The Last Professors, The Corporate University, and The Fate of the Humanities. Thanks to everyone for your great questions and comments. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.